position number 2118, wheel 8.
Fred Cooper relate.
Yeah. So these six, there was no indication that they were prepared to surrender if they'd have put their hands up. We'd have respected that and I'd have just ushered them along. But they stood at the door and I started firing the Bren gun.
Bren gun?
The Sten gun, I beg your pardon. And I couldn't believe it. I heard things going on behind me and it was a cobbled floor. And what was happening? Being used to a Tommy gun, balance, with the Sten gun, you've got to make a firm grip. I didn't learn this till afterwards. A firm grip on the butt end to hold it upright. And consequently, these bullets were hitting the cobbles, bouncing back over me head, knocking the tiles out, and they were landing behind me. And I must have fired off at least six magazines, and these Germans are still there. And all of a sudden, the platoon sergeant, Bill Pickford, I was on my knees firing a Sten gun, and all of a sudden there was a loud shot behind me. And it was the platoon sergeant, one shot from a rifle, and a German dropped down. And I'd fired 180 bullets, I never hit a thing except knocked them up. 3 dozen tiles out, smashed some windows and God knows what. But that's how I evaluated the Sten gun. Absolute rubbish.
Why didn't they put their hands up?
I don't know. I think probably they were too scared to do it, you know. But Bill Pickford, you see, they didn't have their hands up. If they had their hands up, he would have expected that. You know, he's that kind of man. You know, once they put their hands up, they're on your side, virtually. And you always respect that and treat a prisoner. You say, I've always said to myself, well, look, it takes 10 men to keep one in the line. I'm just the unlucky bugger that's in the line, and he's in the same position. And you respect him, you know, he's done his bit, and that's it. But Bill Pickford hit him, and he went down pole-axed, you know. But then the others cleared off, so we went back to the farmhouse, and just unfortunate that we was in the farmyard itself, and the Germans happened to fire a ranging shot. I don't know if it's a shell or a mortar, a ranging shot, and it landed bang on the target. You know, it's a freak, but it happens. And one of our lads, Tom Marshall, when we were in Belgium, I went on leave to Brussels with him for a couple of days. Got to know the lads, you know. He had a family of about four up north somewhere, Yorkshireman, and a devoted family man. And anyway, he went down and we captured about six or seven prisoners by then. And it hit Tom on the leg. So he went down. And I said to these Germans, want that door, you know, get that door down to put him on, you know, take him away. And got no stretchers or anything there. So they pulled this door down and brought it over. And someone said, all right, Tommy said, yeah, I'm all right. So someone lifted his shoulders and I was at the back and went to lift his legs. And one of it just come up like that. All it was hanging on by the back tendon. And so when I realised that, I put him down a little higher part of his leg near the knee and put him on the door. And I said, you all right, Tommy? And he said, no, Fred, me leg. And I picked up his leg and just twisted it round. All right now, Tom. Oh, yeah, that's all right, Fred. And unfortunately, Bren gun carrier came up to take him back. And this was, by this time, was evening. And on the way back, I got stuck, and he died of exposure and neglect. Well, Tom Marshall. But then, the following day, we had another ding-dong battle in this farmhouse, and he kept shelling the place. And they had a family there, and this place sticks in my mind, you know. They had a family there, a grandmother and a daughter, her husband and a small child. And they packed all their belongings on a cart. And about 10 o'clock, he kept shelling this place, you know, 5 or 6 shells at a time. And about 10 o'clock, they went out to get on the cart to drive away. And the Germans see a bit of movement, put a shower of shells down. And we were down the cellar, you know, we had people out in position, and the rest of the platoon down the cellar. And the cellars there in Germany were like a suite of rooms where they used to have, you know, pickled fruit and jars of fruit, shells all over the place. Anyway, we were down the cellar, and these people passed us, and the younger woman had a big hole there.
In her thigh.
Yeah, and she was screaming. The young daughter was screaming, seeing her mother like that. The elder woman, I've never seen a sight like it. She'd had her nose sliced off, and, like, I don't know what it was. I don't understand the makeup of the human face too much. So I know what I've got, I know how to shave it, but... She had like 2 white balloons hanging down here.
And, from her nostrils.
Yeah. And those completely and they took down the cellar, and we tried to get an ambulance to take her back. You know, obviously she needed treatment. And we kept getting back. When an ambulance is available, we send it up, but it's too busy dealing with our own casualties at the moment. So they were in one part of the cellar, and we was in the other. And... all the time, you could hear this lady trying to breathe from, like that. And the noise, you know, haunted you, really. But the next day, this officer, he got an MC for this job, you know, and he earned it. He was a good young officer. And the next day, he said to, he lined a platoon up down the cellar, and he said, look, we got Dessie's body hanging out there, he said, and... he said, I don't like to see any of my men lying out unattended. He said, now I want 2 volunteers to get him back and get him properly buried. So he called for volunteers and nobody volunteered. So I thought, you know, bearing in mind I was the last, so I thought to myself, well, I better show. So I said, I'll volunteer. I put my hand up and said, well, I'll go. Didn't fancy it much, you know, because of the amount of shelling. So Mickey Butler... he was another section leader, he said, well, I'll go with Fred. So the officer said to the rest of the platoon, he said, I'm taking a grave risk here, he said, with 2 of my section leaders, putting them both at risk. And he said, you ought to be ashamed of yourself, you know, and this is the way he spoke to him. So anyway, he said to Mick, he said, I've got a Bren gun carrier coming up. He said, get a door, he said, and then get him off that ridge and put him on the carrier, take him back to company headquarters. By that time, there was a lot of activity going on. B Company were going through us. This is at the Schlieffen Line. You know the Schlieffen Line? It's the end of the seafood line. And anyway, B Company come through us. The second in command of the company, I've seen him since in Denmark a couple of years ago, a Major Denham. He, up in the air he went, he's stone deaf as a result, his driver lost 2 feet, going over a mine. Later on, the company commander charged a pill box, got within 6 feet of it, and then got shot. But going back to the question of Dossett, while we were waiting for it to come up, another officer came down the cellar and Lieutenant Elgar said to me, this is a great friend of mine, Sergeant Cooper, he said, Dwayne Bramall. So I shook hands, first time I'd ever met Bramall, you know. And anyway, up come the Bren gun carrier, and this is interesting really, because when it came up, we took the door out, and we got getting Dossett's body down, and a salvo shells come down. They were coming down quite frequently. And so we went to ground. The Bengal carrier driver stayed in his carrier, but it was right out of his life. And as soon as we came down and got the body on the door, and the door on the Bengal carrier, so he tried to move off. Well, with Bengal carriers, they're different to normal vehicles because they rock quite a lot. And consequently, the body and the door fell off. So me and Mick Butler had to put the body back on the door, lift the door up and put it back on the carrier, and we had to run behind the carrier holding it. Anyway, when we got a safe distance away, we went back to company headquarters, and the interesting part about company headquarters was the place was empty except there was three signallers there, you know, in contact with the company commander and the platoons, one platoon out there and one platoon there. And there was just a company sergeant major there. This company sergeant major, you've only got to look at him, there's a picture of him in that book. He was not the normal type of sergeant major that you see, you know. He was small, he spoke rather quietly, and he was a gentlemanly type, George Slater. Now, Dossett had always been a problem to him. The lads used to walk about with all his buttons undone, you know, and I can hear George Slater now. So, gosh it, do you know, that sort of thing. Well, we brought the body back, and I went into company headquarters, and I see George, and he said, oh, hello, Fred, what's up? So I said, well, I just brought the body back for burial, George. Oh, how's it going up there, you know, and I brought him up to date with things. Who's going to be buried then? So I said, young Dossett. And tears immediately welled down his face. And he come out and he looked at him, honourable. Bring him round the garden, he said. So I brought him round the garden, me and Mick. So he said, he had a shovel, he said, leave this to me. And he's digging away there. He said, have a blow, go and see the signals, get yourself a cup of tea, he said, and come back about an hour. So I went back about an hour's time and he just about finished the hole. Give me a hand, he said, lifted him into the hole. He then opened up his pocket, took out his AB-64 and his identity disc, walked to the other end, like that, and he held it for quite a few seconds, you know.
A salute.
Yeah, and then he said, well, you better get back now, and we left him with a shovel in his hand, tears still streaming down his face, and never forget that. But, going back to the battle, we had, you know, one day run into another. First time in my life that I'd been 2.5 days without sleep was up in that area around Cleve, Gok, Udham, around the slipping line. There was very fierce battles around there, and we went 2.5 days without sleep. And you know, when you do sleep, I think very few people experience this, particularly during war when things are not going, you know, when you see your comrades and mates getting killed and that. If you go 2.5 days without sleep, I slept for 18 hours. And when I woke up, like a lot of other people, I was in the most depressed state possible. Couldn't be more depressed, you know. Thought, you know, can't go on like this, you're going to get killed tomorrow, you know, it's in here, you feel it, so depressed, it's unbelievable. But we got relieved in that position, and by some Canadian C4th we got attached to, and it really was, around that area, really was fierce battles. We had lots of casualties. I can remember a little incident that happened probably before that, because that really was the cracking of the Germans, you know. After that, it was more or less, we went to the Elbe, you know, and the war was virtually over then, you know, but I can remember a little incident before we got to the Elmentoft farmhouse. We'd been doing daylight attack, and we had one or two casualties, and we really had a shell fire, and we were in some area, it wasn't trees, nothing that give you protection, like bushes. And the shells were landing in this, you know, and it was not very nice, you know. You were concealed from view, but he knew you were there, and he was putting the shells down, and you were exposed, you know. You had no trees to get behind or anything like that. And we had this from about 8 o'clock in the morning, and we finished up about 6 o'clock at night at a crossroads. And this crossroad had previously been held by the Germans, and they put zigzag trenches around, you know, about 3 lines of them, which suited us down the ground. But at the end of the day, we got there, and this we stopped about 300 or 400 yards short of this crossroad. There was a house on the crossroad, so the officer said to me, beyond that house, he said, there's a large mansion, he said, onto my ground. He said, now, I'm on a 3-man patrol, he said, yourself and Davis, he was my brain gunner, Davis, you know, quite a good bloke in action. He said, now, what we're going to do, he said, we go to that farmhouse first, he said, and reconnoitre that, make sure that's clear, and then go on to the mansion. So he said, the rest of the platoon will be giving us covering. You know, if we have to get out, they'll get us out. Well, there was a lad in that platoon who joined us about a month before, and he had met my wife's sister, and he was courting her at the time and writing to her. And when he first joined the regiment, he came along, he said, you're Fred Cooper. I said, yeah. He shook hands with me, he said, I'm Courtney Nan, Sophie's sister, you know, that's my wife, Sophie. So, you know, I had some sort of relationship with it. We were both courting two sisters. Well, on this particular day, he was only a youngster, he was about 19, you know, barely 19. So the officer nominated myself and Davis to do the patrol with him, and the rest were covering fire. So we were waiting for the off, and he come up to me crying his eyes out. So I said, what's the matter with you? So he said, we've had all this joint today. He said, now I'm out on patrol tonight. And tears were streaming down his face. So, you know, what can you say? I wasn't in a very happy mood. You know, I'd been suffering the same as him during the course of the day. And I had to be quite blunt with him. I said, what's the matter with you, silly bastard? You're not out on patrol. I said, me and Davis are on patrol. I said, you'll just give us covering fire. If we get any trouble, I said, you get us out. So with that, I left it at that. Well, we'd done the patrol, and the house on the crossroads, we got down the cellar there, and there was about 6 Germans down there, and one of them badly wounded, lying on a bed, and about 4 women who lived in the place, you know, surrounding him. And looked down there, and one of the women said to me, I was a cigarette, and, you know, he wanted a fag. Like, so I died down, I'd pack the woodbines or something, I'd give it about 3 or 4, and then we went up. And anyway, then we got fired at. So, lobbed a couple of grenades, and waited there for about half an hour for a reaction. Nothing happened, and the officer said, well, we better go and do this mansion. So we get to the back of the house, and there's so the reason they wanted to do it was on high ground, you know, and there was a slope up to it. So if there was anybody in there, you're vulnerable, you know. So we went up this high ground, and I think we got within 50 yards of the place. And I think the officer had had enough, you know, so he came over to me and he said, would you think there was anybody in there? So I said, well, you know, my experience, I said, it's doubtful whether they'd let us get this far with the moon. That. He said, that's where I thought. He said, I think we withdraw and go back and safely assume that it's clear. So we went back and he reported it clear. So then they told us to take up positions on this crossroad in these zigzag trenches which the Germans had built. So They put a platoon in each trench. Well, then, I was at the back run, my section, and I was nearer to the road and the crossroad. And at night, there was an attack going in. On the basis that we'd established that that mansion was clear, there was an attack going in by the 53rd Welsh Division. And what a night we had. I was at the end of the trench, and every time, so these Welshmen jumped in the trench, and I was black and blue, with them jumping on top of me. Yeah. But anyway, they got through, and they were going through all night. And in the morning, about 9 o'clock, the company commander came up, and he said, I think we've got enough in front of us now. He said, you can pull back. But he said, I want you to pull back a section at a time. So he went on and told the next section, told the next one. So I pulled back to a barn, which was about 200 yards away. And when I pulled back there, had a restless night, I thought, well, we'll get some sleeping in a minute. So everybody else is making tea and all that, cooking some food. And I stopped by the barn door and watched the others come in. Well, when they came in, they were in single file, and he must have watched us coming in and took a point on that. And as soon as they got about 10 yards, so he put some of our shells down. And I can remember looking at the bloke at the front of the section, and a shell landed right in front of his foot, and he looked for all the world to me as if he'd kicked it. You know, he was walking and landed right, completely unhurt. But they went down, and I ran out, and I dealt with, me and somebody else dealt with one of the casualties. There were about three others. Anyway, up come the ambulance, and the chap in the ambulance I knew, Corporal Burge, and he loaded the casualties in. So I said to him, how's young Dusty Miller? Freddy said he's got a bit through the head and a bit through his lung. He said he won't see it back. And sure, this is the young lad I was talking about. And sure enough, about 20 minutes later, message come through. Rifleman Miller, dead. And this was the lad that was engaged to, or not engaged, but caught in my wife or the lady I was caught in, it was her sister. So I had to write quite a lengthy letter back to the family explaining the situation. And
what was the name of this place?
What?
Where this action took place?
Well, there was it was up near the Schlieffen line. Places like Cleve, Gok, Udham, all around the area, where there was pretty savage fighting. You know, the Germans, it was the Seafield line, and it was a prepared line of defence. You know, at that time you can recall many incidents. I can remember on one occasion, you know, really humorous incidents. One night we're in Germany and we suddenly got an order to move urgently. And we must have gone about 30 miles down these roads where there's thick forest each side, you know. See nothing. And we finished up in a village. And when we got in this village, there's a German motorcycle and sidecar outside the house. When we looked through the door, because there was a German in there, a mirror in the hall, and he's putting his helmet on, you know, completely unaware that we were there. And you know, there was a complete company there. So, gives us a right across the road, line up, brand guns on them. And the Germans must have suddenly become aware that we were there, you know. And they tried to get away, obviously not realising the strength that we were, thought perhaps one or two. And one of them come out firing a machine gun. And, not me, you know, submachine gun of some kind. And they tried to get in this vehicle and get away, about four of them. Well, when they come out, we heard a tremendous yell from one of our boats. And then, of course, our machine guns, our Bren guns, got onto them. And before you knew where you were, they had full corpses there, you know. But the land of ours went down. And this is laughable, really. He was an ex-regular soldier. And he'd gone down, and they said he'd been shot in the leg. What had happened? They fired at him, and it had hit him, but inside his trouser pocket was one of the army pocket watches. And although he was badly bruised, he finished up with a pocket full of watch springs and bits and pieces. But on this particular occasion, I'll never forget it, we took up a position on a crossroad. And my section was designated to patrol this, not to take up a position on it. And there was a tank against the side of the wall. Well, there was a house there, and so I looked round and in this house, and I saw a nice bed. So I thought to myself, well, that'd be handy, I'll have a sleep there. So I laid on the bed, and I went to sleep, and all of a sudden, the Lance Corporal woke me up. Fred, there's some, they're creeping up on our position. So I thought to myself, oh, I went out and dozed off again, you know. Fred, come. So I went out there anyway, and there's the other chap there, Davis. So I said, well, where are they? Well, there's one over there. I don't know if there's any more, but there's one over there. So with that, we charged across the road. I couldn't believe it in the dark. This chap was in this ditch. And when he unrolled himself, he looked to me about 6'9". I don't think he was that big, but he looked at, you know, the way he unrolled himself, and there's three of us standing together, and I looked at him, and his hands looked like shovels, you know, and I thought to myself, well, if he claps his hands and bangs our three heads together, so anyway, we stood back, and then the chap in the tank, who'd taken up position just around the corner, you're right there, Jock, you know, and when this German saw him, I don't think he had any ideas, but I think that put pay to him completely, so I thought to myself, well, you know, we catch him, what do we do with him? You know, when you catch a prisoner, you've got to get rid of him. So I took him back, and they had a little sort of village square there. And there's only one person here, and that was Rowley Gibbs. And he's 6'4". So he's on the bonnet of a car with his torch, and he's working out something, you know. So I said to him, just captured a prisoner, sir. Keep creeping up on our position. Oh, very good, Sergeant Cooper. Every little helps, he said. So I said, don't know what to do with him. So when he looked up at this German, he said, that's your problem, and he buggered off. But on that, another humorous story connected with that, we took up another position in this village where, I don't know if you can understand the position where you've got an old established church, and they want to build a road. And rather than demolish the church, they build a road and go round the church. Well, they put us in such a churchyard, had a parapet wall, and it had some sort of sagebrush growing in there. And it also had some memorial stones in there, you know, people buried there. And that sagebrush, you know, you could imagine it was human remains or something. You were smelling a bit depressing. But anyway, we're in this place, and I was a bit worried about it. I thought, well, the Germans were down there. If he knows his position and fires something down the middle of the road, he's bound to hit this place, you know. So anyway, we're in there, and we're in there all night. About 4 o'clock in the morning, down comes a company commander. And when he's about, you know, you hear the lads, what the bloody hell does he want? You know, hello, what are we up to now? So he was talking to the platoon commander, Elgar, and then he said, Elgar called me over. And he said, never forget this. He said, Sergeant Cooper, he said, just before first light, I want you to do a patrol. The company commander stand at the side of him, you know, and He said, now go down here about 300 yards. He said, across the road, down here about 300 yards. He said, you'll find an opening. Farmhouse on the left, farm buildings on the right. He said, now go through.